Welcome to another episode of the Small Chops Podcast. The goal here is to renegotiate the social contract, but first, observing, understanding, and a little bit of dissecting of where we came from, the tools that we have, and what the current social contract is, and what needs to be renegotiated. This past week, I was able to take a little trip and find things that jogged my memories of long ago. Feels like a couple of lifetimes ago, where I was able to enjoy the fall of the Northeast United States. And that's where I find myself, the perfect time of year, right when, you know, the days can be as high as 70 degrees and the nights could be as low as 39. And a couple of storms, a couple of really, really sunny days, a couple of cloudy days. Like, it was a perfect mix of weather. And everything that I really missed about being in this area, haven't been over here for almost 20 years now. To return to see the lives of the friends that I've made back then has been fantastic. To see the depths of their lives, to see the generations that they've brought, to see the homeownership, to see the businesses that have been put together in these last 20 years has been a great experience so far. And it's brought me that longing of community again, you know? That desire to kind of see those friends grow and to grow with them and to see how you could, you know, affect each other, lean on each other, support each other. It's been great. I'm not really seeing signs of the supply chain shortage that's been affecting the world, although we are heading into the holiday season when it comes to shopping and when it comes to the availability of sales and items and things like that. I think this year is going to be a little different, and I expected to see a lot of, you know, proof of that, whether it be in grocery stores or convenience stores, liquor stores, or computer shops. I was really expecting to see, I guess, a lot worse than what I'm seeing right now, but things don't seem to be that bad at all. And it could be delaying the inevitable, and it could be that, you know, people are really good at figuring things out and, you know, working without. So I have been enjoying this trip for sure. And on this trip, I was talking to a friend's mother, and she reminded me of how things were. And she gave me a really good analogy about, I guess, rough times, tough times, easy times, rough people, tough people, and weak people. And I'm going to read just a little bit of it. It sounded like one of those WhatsApp forward threads. If any of you have, you know, international friends and those that love passing on those threads, here's what this one said. I was just watching an exclusive BBC interview, and one thing that caught my attention was when they asked the man about the future of his country. He said, "My father was on a camel. I'm in a Mercedes. My son is on a Land Rover. My grandson will be in a Land Rover. And my great-grandson will be on a camel." The reporter asked, "Why is that?" And he said, "Tough times create strong men. Strong men create easy times. Easy times create weak men. And weak men create tough times." So this was one of those, hey, you know, we did for you, and you should be, you know, happy about the way the world is for you versus the way it was for us growing up, and how much access you have to this and that, and what technology has done for you, blah, blah, blah. And while I appreciate that and I understand the sentiment, I couldn't help but think that she referred to her generation as the tough generation, and the generation that we're coming up in, a generation of I guess, easy times, which makes for weak people, weak men. And I just wanted to offer some pushback when it came to that, because I don't agree. I don't think that these times now are easier than the times in the past. I would even argue that our parents were actually the ones that were made weak because of the certainties that they had that we weren't afforded, right? When you grew up in the 60s and 70s, I can't imagine anywhere in the world would have been, any Western country or even, you know, developed African country would have been Well, you know, let me not say that, because I'm sure there was plenty of strife in a lot of the developing world. But what I can say is, from the experiences that I had, my parents grew up in Nigeria in the 70s, and at that time, the dollar and the naira were very, very close together. Were very, you know, similar in strength. It was maybe not one to one, but it was really close. And I understand that Nigeria is still one of the top 10 oil producing nations in the world, and that that wealth was still being brought back into the country. And during these times, I imagine getting a job in the oil field, getting a job anywhere, going, you know, education was relatively easy. There were a lot of visas being given to students who wanted to study overseas, and that's how my parents came over to the States. And there was certainty, you know. You got a job, you knew your career, you worked towards that career, you got a degree. That degree would have afforded you the opportunity to get a job that you may have had for a lifetime. And I think that crumbled a little bit, or a lot of it, during the 80s. All over the world, there were economic strife in America. They definitely dealt with the crack epidemic in the urban city areas, which really threw a wrench in the generational wealth sector of not only low-income families, but black immigrant families as well. And those were definitely tough times, and those tough times were never rectified, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think that there was a real bounce back from the 80s. I don't think that, you know, wealth distribution was at a pinnacle in the 90s or 2000s, and I definitely don't think that it is anywhere it could be right now in the 2020s. I say that to say, you know, again, to offer a little bit of pushback as to what that person was talking about when she spoke about the generation of tough times that create, you know, strong people. And if any generation has tougher times than this past generation that has had to suffer two financial crises that's had to go through the drastic change of international and domestic travel when it came to 9/11, when it comes to just, you know, privacy, when it comes to wealth, when it comes to school. I think we are the generation where school became a business, where schools really took advantage of all-inclusive rent and really nice recreation centers. I don't think there was a real focus on the quality of the education, despite there being record numbers of collegiate graduates. A lot of my friends that graduated college when I was in college came back to college after, what, 6 months, simply because, you know, the opportunities were not there. And that was kind of the beginning of the transition from the certainty of, you know, work hard, go to school, get a good job, and start the rest of your life. Your career was on that path. Now, if you're in law, if you're in medicine, if you're in any of the sciences, I definitely think that may still be the case, especially if you're going for the particular sciences, STEM research and things like that, engineering, computer science. But when it comes to, I guess, the liberal arts, when it comes to business administration, when it comes to writing, those careers were definitely changed, and there were not the opportunities. And I don't know if that was because we were a generation of weak people. I think that we kind of were, we trusted how things have been. We trusted tradition. We trusted that tradition was going to help us transition into adulthood. We trusted the risk of getting student loans and being able to pay those off in a timely manner. I think we were also the generation the first generation student loans could not be forgiven if someone filed for bankruptcy. And so that changed in my generation as well, because again, record number of people were graduating school with high amounts of debt and with no opportunities to begin to pay those debts off. And there had to be some kind of reconciliation of all those issues. And I couldn't disagree with her more, but respectfully, I listened to her as an older woman, as a hopefully a more wise person. And I really took it to heart. I started thinking about, came up with a couple of questions that I wanted to ask, but I didn't ask her directly. It was more so because she didn't come up with that thread. It was a sentiment that she was sharing with me and something that I just needed to reflect upon, because I think that we have a generation of people who really think their lives contributed to our lives in a positive way, and that our lives are significantly more easy growing up in, you know, the internet age than it would have been growing up in any other age beforehand. So the argument of us being the generation of people to enjoy easy times and therefore being created weak, that just really didn't sit well with me, especially those of us that are vehemently trying to carve our own path in this world, in our lives, that are not going according to the model of what, you know, adulthood should be, simply because that's not working for us anymore. Who wants high debt? Who wants high interest rates? Who wants a mortgage for 40 years? Just, you know, for what? What value does that add? What value does that bring to those of us that are looking for a little bit more out of life? And I couldn't agree that we are a generation of the recipients of easy times. So when did those easy times end? Where are those easy times now? Is it now because of the internet? Is it now because we have email addresses? Is it because we have tablets and cell phones? Is it because we can put into addresses and prepay for a car that shows up at our doorstep in 10 minutes that we have easier times? Or are those easier times more measured by wealth generation? Is it measured by home ownership? Is it measured by how much people are actually able to do the leisure things in life? How much of our lives is still related to the antiquated 40-hour work week? How much of our lives is still dictated by someone we don't know? How much of our workday, how much of our responsibilities are out of our control and out of our hands? How much creativity, how much of ourselves can we bring to work, someplace that we spend most of our waking day? Just where are these improvements when it comes to the day? What did the previous generation do to prepare us for what we're dealing with right now? How are we dealing with the fact that if you were born in the mid to late 80s or 90s, you are paying into a Social Security fund that you're not going to, you know, benefit from? How many of us were prepared to do something like that? And how many of us were prepared to be immigrants in this country? How many of our parents, fell for American media or the grass is always greener syndrome? How much of our identities are forever altered because somebody wanted a better opportunity in a land that they thought was better than their own? In my mind, proofs of a very difficult time because of a lack of either conviction or leadership or maybe even religion. As people were moving away from religion, we're moving much closer to something else. We're moving closer to figuring it out on our own. We're moving away from what has been, what should be, quote unquote, and moving towards figuring something new out, something dynamic, something that hopefully works for us. And the only problem with that is, for me personally, the only problem that I have with this is, where are these inspirations coming from? If you were to do your research and you found a country that you think is going to, you know, have your best interests at heart, and because of their medical program, because of their educational program, because of their tax policies, because of their civil rights policies? Or is it just because of their cultural exports? It's because you fell for whatever movies, for whatever news clippings, for whatever stories you heard about that country. And you were like, hey, you know what? I want to do it over there because people that look like me, people that have opportunities to excel, the land of millionaires, quote unquote. It's just a lot that I think didn't go into proper planning when it comes to preparing the current leaders to be for their positions in the world. And many of them didn't want those positions because we already see how either politics rule or corruption rule or nepotism rule. And it doesn't seem to be something that has the greatest number of people at heart. And I think in our generation as well, we moved. Many of our parents moved to the States, to Canada, to UK, outside of their native land. And it was less about political strife. It was less about danger. It was less about, just not being able to live an adequate life. And it was more about wanting to be better, wanting to live better, wanting to have more opportunities, wanting to be in a land that seemed progressive, more progressive than your land versus making your land progressive. I had a really interesting conversation on Clubhouse a little while ago. And, you know, there are still very much aggressive conversations between African immigrants and African Americans, or, you know, foundational Black Americans, and how there's not enough communication in either direction. I think I think that there seems to be the notion of, you know, hey, if I'm leaving a country that I can't speak up in public, or I don't have access to certain, you know, information or power, then I am as disenfranchised as someone who has grown up generationally in a country that has suppressed not only their voice, but their humanity. And it is a peculiar place to be, because on one hand, I know what it's like to be an immigrant in this country. And on the other hand, I've been in this country long enough, and I've taken interest in the Black experience enough to do my research and to understand a little bit more of how, you know, generational, what would you call it? Generational withholding, generational abuse. There's a specific word that I'm looking for. But how the experience in America for people, for, you know, 80, what is it, ADOS? African descendants of slaves. There we go. African descendants of slaves in America, and how different that experience is from almost any other country in this world, simply because of identity, because of cultural cohesion, and because of history. And all of those were taken away. So no matter how difficult life is for someone in Uganda, someone in Rwanda, someone in Nigeria, those people still have access to their culture. They still have access to their identity, and they still have access to, you know, what makes them, you know, their roots. And I think any tree with roots can sustain any kind of storm, no matter how destructive that storm can be, no matter how much is lost. With those roots, it can begin again, versus, you know, a tree that has no roots and a tree that is just forced to weather whatever storm comes without roots. And that is a very, very, very different story, a very tumultuous history. And it is something that, I don't know, I guess I didn't know it still caused contention, but being in that Clubhouse group, I found out why. Because people aren't listening to each other enough. You know, the Black experience in America, African descendants of slaves have had something that is very peculiar. And that is the stripping of identity and culture, which in my readings has not happened to many other cultures. So this preparation, these easy times, we really need to have a reconsideration of what's going on, because I can't imagine these times being easy. I can't imagine anyone calling these easy times, simply because there are more millionaires, or there's more exposure to police brutality, or there's more opportunities to invest. All of that creates, you know, hopefully a society with more options, but there's still very much a controlling mechanism that does not allow for there to be exponential growth, does not allow for there to be a catching up of sorts. And we, you know, we hold the Oprahs and the Will Smiths and the LeBrons in the world and say, hey, you know what, if 12 people can do it, maybe anybody can do it. And I think that that is part, again, of American, what would you call it? American cultural marketing. People believing that, and there not being enough of an actual ear given to the people that have been here, you know, given to the people that know what this place is, given to the people that know what the story of America is, know what, you know, if the grass is green over here, that means they're using something besides water. And it isn't necessarily for the benefit of those that want to come here and experience it. So let us create easier times for those that come behind us. But it feels really difficult during these times, you know. In our parents' generation, we had presidents, we had leaders who were in their 40s and 50s. And now our presidential candidates or our presidential options in this last election were all in their 70s. We're all in their 70s, at least the last three. And they're just, it's going to be a disconnect. There's going to be a lot of cohesion lost with there being, you know, 40, 50 year difference between the presidential candidate and someone who may be a first or second time voter. So, I can't imagine these hard times being looked at or considered easy. And I can't imagine the generation that's coming up behind me, the people that, you know, the internet generation, the people that have really taken to social media as a norm, people that I've grown up just watching and not wanting to be a part of that system. You know, that's why I think you're seeing a record number of people tattooing their faces, people coloring their hair, people trying to be countercultural as much as possible, even though counterculture has its own has been co-opted and has become its own culture. I think that there's still a push. And if that isn't being recognized, if that isn't being considered when it comes to, you know, whether we are looking at this generation or the last generation as weak or strong, we have to have a better guide. We have to have better opinions. We have to have a little bit more holistic view of what's going on. And I don't think we can leave it up to our parents' generation to understand that, because for whatever reason, I can't even begin to believe that someone would think that these are easier times than before. You know, someone that's so close to retirement can really say that, but can they say that we're going to have that same opportunity? I think Dick Gregory, may you rest in peace, really was the first, you know, older person in my life. I think I listened to him when I was in college for the first time. He came and visited, and he said, "We left a mess for you guys to figure out." And that was so empowering, because it was somebody older, somebody who was here, somebody who's been an activist, you know, for the majority of his life, and a public figure in the eye, having access to politicians, entertainers, people of high wealth, people of high power, people of notoriety, and not having a solution, not having alternatives to be offered, but to really say, hey, you know what, the generation before you, the couple of generations before you messed up, and we've left a mess for you guys to figure out. And that faith in being able to not only identify what was done and not offering solutions, but trusting and having faith that we will figure these things out, and having that having that push has been really great. Having that adherence, not push, but having that acknowledgement has been really encouraging. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, it's not about giving us the solutions, and it's not about reminding us that we're in a mess, but the acknowledgement to say that, hey, I did this. I wronged you. We wronged you. And we don't have anything for you right now, but we have faith in you that you will figure this out. Man, that is motivating, I think. And that is very encouraging. And that is exactly the kind of elder, you know, that would, you know, be beneficial one way or the other. Our elders don't necessarily have to have the answers. Our elders don't necessarily have to give us guidance. But that acknowledgement, oh man, I think that's huge. So those of you that are in these tough times right now, just understand that these tough times create strong people. And I guess it'd be great to have weak kids, right? It'd be great to make the world, quote unquote, a better place or more comfortable for more than just our families, for as many families as we can, to make these social injustices a thing of the past, to make discrimination something to be ashamed of, and to move forward in a way that we can be proud of our contributions to our children's lives. And it goes beyond technology, you know, that our kids' social dynamics have improved, that their relationships have improved, that their ways of relating with each other, their confidence in knowing and how to build a community has been fostered because they were poured into by the generations before them. And not being a battery for the generations that came before them, but actually being poured into, you know. Imagine a tree demanding of its fruit to nourish it. And I think that we are in that kind of twisted world right now, but the acknowledgement goes a long way. Yeah, I just wanted to leave you with that. And no, that's not a good way to end this, but I'm going to say that again. These have just been thoughts on my mind. That has been something that I've been really interested in sharing with you. And give me some feedback. Leave some feedback on social media, EFFABL on Twitter. That's effable, EFFABL.co on Instagram, as well as the website. The website is EFFABL.co, where you can find this and many other conversations with myself, with you, and with other guests. Thank you for listening to the Small Shops Podcast.